Bean, Senator Adams, and myself, Senator Torgerson. We were going to take up Senate Bill 88 first, but the sponsors held up somewhere else, so we will go to House Bill 12. Since the sponsor is here and ready to go, will be the first bill we take up. This is an act relating to the easement for the extension of the Alaska Railroad to the Alaska-Canadian border. Representative James, welcome to the committee. If you'll give us your overview of the bill, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some of you may have recalled in 1994 when I was working on the railroad, and I did a delineation authorization for a railroad corridor from Burbank to the Kula Peninsula. And at that time, I also had another piece of legislation which would appropriate $10,000 to the corridor from Eielson to the Canadian border to determine the cost of acquiring the right-of-way within an already identified corridor. Well, during the last couple of years, because the authorization for this corridor had been on the books since early 80s and had been delineated by air reconnaissance of a centerline easement and was on the map and nothing was happening, they did do a cost of acquiring a right-of-way and spent about $7,600 of the $10,000. But they dropped withdrew their application with BLM and also took them off of DNR and erased it, basically. And so when I found out about that this last year, I said, well, I want to get that back on there. I thought it was there, and when I did the $10,000, I thought that would make people aware that we're still interested in this project, and of course, they said there was no interest. So that was a mistake, And so what I started to do here was just reauthorize that same authorization that was already on the books to bring it to the attention of people that were still interested in this project. And also what we've done in this in-house finance, what they did is get the drawings to be sure they're all on DNR's map. That's not a recorded necessarily right away, but certainly if you look at any DNR maps, you'll see that corridor that's been delineated. So it's a simple thing. It just authorizes the delineation of a corridor subject to legislative appropriation. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I know that you're really busy and probably don't want to hear the saga of the railroad. I have a lot more to talk about.
Okay. Questions of the sponsor?
I said the better.
Here to be none. Senator Lehman.
What's the difference between the $30,000 study and the system of the original $10,000?
The one from the 1994? There should be no fiscal note on this bill.
I know, but if you look at the back of the fiscal analysis, point number one.
Well, let me find it. Well, Hilton is here from the Department of Transportation. Maybe you could ask him to respond to that, because we're just talking, and what we have in here shouldn't cost any extra money at all.
Okay. You want to join us at the table? Whoever. Okay. Introduce yourself for the record, please, and answer Senator Lehman's question.
I'm Frank Milking, Chief of Right-of-Way for Department of Transportation here in DNR.
Okay. Go ahead. Did you hear the question of Senator Lehman?
I believe the question was, Senator, from Senator Lehman, Mr. Chairman, that question, what was the difference between the $30,000 appropriation and what we're doing today? What this bill says, and the $30,000 appropriation was for reconnaissance, title work, and those things that have already been identified. So we still have that information there in the files. We still know where the route was, and we still know why we chose that route or why that route was selected. So that data is still there. It's just a matter of, one, putting it on the DNR records having a special statute for it, so it wasn't done under the normal DNR statutes and the normal DNR procedures. And this will be noted on the plat with this, the statute number when it's still codified, so that it won't be, you know, under their normal review when they go through and say there's been no action on this for 5 years, let's take it off the plat. We'll have a notation and somebody can see that the statute means that this is to be kept on there indefinitely.
Frank, can you, is 500, this says a right-of-way of not less than 500 feet. Is that a normal right-of-way for the railroad, that wide?
Mr. Chairman, that's not a normal right-of-way operational, but for planning and reconnaissance purposes, you normally, the same thing with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, that was identified as a 300-foot corridor, ultimately reduced down to 100 feet after it went operational, and then the rest of the right-of-way went back to the state. Their right-of-way was reduced. So that's very difficult practice to have a very wide right-of-way to start out with in the reconnaissance phase and then ultimately get down to narrow rights-of-way as there are other uses for the land.
Other questions? Senator Adams.
You know, some of the costs that we see that will occur is going to be in the future, Frank, whether it's the DNR or DOT, you know, whether it's you acquire the right-of-way that costs $6.3 or $6.4 million, don't you think that these costs should be borne by the Alaska Railroad versus Department of Natural Resources or DOT or other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, we anticipated down the road that that would happen to ultimately the entity that would need the railroad right-of-way, want the railroad wide right-of-way, would be the Alaska Railroad. Regardless of who actually does the work and who actually spends the money, it would be the railroad funding through the railroad or the railroad would do that.
Does any place in this House bill state that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, no, it doesn't.
If I might respond also, Senator Adams, to your question, because there is, it says in here that the money can come from various sources, including private funds, and quite frankly, I'm not convinced that it'll even be the Alaska Railroad. It might be another interested party that would be interested in doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If there's other questions, pardon me. Senator Parnell.
Mr. Chairman, I would move CS for sponsor substitute for House Bill Number 12, Finance Amended, from Committee's individual recommendations and the accompanying description notes.
Motion to move the bill. Is there objection? Hearing none, House Bill 12 moves with individual recommendations. Thank you. We will next go back to Senate Bill 88. This is an act relating to the license of dietitians and providing for an effective date. Senator Donnelly.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 88 provides for title licensing for dietitians and nutritionists in Alaska. Any questions by the people who practice these two professions? Currently, there's no limitation on who can call themselves a dietitian or a nutritionist. It would be title licensure. In other words, it would allow people to meet certain criteria to utilize that title. There's no The department wouldn't be testing those and certifying them, it would just be authorizing people to have those titles. It would allow Alaskans to differentiate between individuals who are qualified and those who are not. Dietitians and nutritionists have become more and more a part of everyday health care, and in fact there's legislation pending in Congress which would include reimbursement for nutrition services within the Medicare program, but only to those recognized by the state as nutrition professionals. So without this licensure, Alaskans wouldn't be able to get recoup those costs through the Medicare program that will be available. Legislation in a nutshell, it's completely supported by the fees that would be charged to the folks that would seek these licenses. So there's a zero fiscal impact on the state and net zero. I believe there's some folks here today to testify in support of the legislation. There is a proposed committee substitute in the members' packet. It would do two things. at the request of the department on line, on page 2, line 26, it would delete the current language after a hearing. The department wanted the flexibility not to have to have a hearing on whether or not to initially issue a license to someone. They could, the way it was worded was problematic. Of course, under the Administrative Procedures Act, they would always have a hearing, but it wouldn't have to do it before the decision not to issue. And second, we added authorization for the department to adopt regulations, specifically authorization to adopt regulations to implement the chapter. Those are the only, that's on page 3, line 26 through 27. Those are the only two changes in the proposed CS. Did you want me to move the CS now or wait until after public testimony?
Let's wait for testimony. And is there questions of the sponsor at this point? Hearing none, then we'll go to public testimony. I'll just start down the list. John Ray? Ray?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. my name is John Ray. I'm the registered dietitian at Bartlett Regional Hospital here in Juneau. I wish to thank Senator Donnelly for introducing this bill and wish to thank the Finance Committee for taking the time to consider our bill this day. As mentioned, I represent the Alaska Dietetic Association, which is a group representing dietitians in Alaska, nutritionists in Alaska. We strongly support this bill. Currently, there are 39 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, who have some form of licensing for dietitians and nutritionists. In Alaska, there are over 120 dietitians in Alaska and nutritionists who are Alaskan residents working in a wide variety of settings of hospitals, continued care facilities, outpatient clinics, private practice, school districts, WIC departments, University of Alaska system, departments of education, health and social services. Very simply, our reasons, as mentioned in the sponsor statement, is for professional recognition. I work in a field where my health care team that I work with, physical therapists, nurses, doctors, pharmacists, respiratory therapists, occupational therapists, are all licensed, recognized as professionals in the state of Alaska. We think dietitians and nutritionists should be on the same playing field. Secondly, we wish to be in line for potential reimbursement for Medicare once a piece of legislation is passed by the 106th Congress. The fiscal note that you have, which was released, shows that the Department of Occupational Licensing will not require any new staffing to facilitate this licensing process. Our members will pay the administration costs. I know you have a lot of bills to meet today, so I will conclude my testimony with that.
Questions of Mr. Ray? Senator Phillips.
Not so much of a question, it's probably some comments, maybe you can respond to it. I have a constituent very concerned about this bill, and I'll make the point. No money to police it, no enforcement, have to pay $410, creating another bureaucracy, also creating two classes of dietitians, I understand, as an internship.
Excuse me, Senator, it's background noise. Oh. Too much rock and roll when I was young. I can't hear very well. So.
Okay. I'm going to go through my notes here. The concerns brought out are no money to police it, no enforcement.
Do it one at a time, and maybe you could respond each one, if that's what you want me to do.
I just want to list them out first, and then we can go from there. They're concerned about no money to police it, no enforcement, $410 to be paid, creating another bureaucracy, creating two classes of dietitians. Should be a grandfather clause in there. And as far as the consumers are concerned, it was suggested that they can go to the American Dietitian Association, and that association can revoke their registration status. And there's a apparently some kind of review panel. And then the other concern is on the exemptions on page 3, line 20. I'll go through that again for you so you understand. Okay, so let me just go through it again. No money to police it, no enforcement, concerned about $410 paid, creating another bureaucracy, creating two classes of dietitians, and there should be a grandfather clause in there. Consumers, if they have a problem with the existing dietitians, can go to the American Dietitian Association to revoke their registration, thus their status as a dietitian. And the exemption part, page 3, line 20. Those are the main concerns with the bill.
Senator, regarding the exemptions, there's two of them listed. Is both of them are a concern for you, or?
Yes.
Pardon?
What was the concern with the exemptions?
Well, they felt that there should be no exemptions, period.
For animals and federal employees.
I know. I'm just pointing them out here.
Senator, if it's okay, well, what I can do is I can relate to, I think I can answer most of these concerns for all the points you bring up. This CS that has gone through a lot of rework, because I basically wrote the original piece of legislation. I reviewed 20 other states that have currently licensure or attempted licensure before, and also ran this past the last American Dietetic Association PAC office in Washington, D.C., which they're happy with the bill. The initial fiscal note that had money for policing, for the enforcement, created a situation where myself and my peers were going to pay $668 every 2 years to be licensed. After my members felt all the air get sucked out of the room, they figured that is not going to work. We looked into making the bill a certification, but in my understanding is there's not a lot of difference between certification and licensure within the Alaska statutes. So this becomes a title protection solely, to get down to that $410 every 2 years. So in the process of doing that CS, the enforcement mechanism and some of the money for the policing was removed, mainly to clear up, to simplify the language so that that extra cost would not administrate.
are organizations that mainly the American Board of Nutrition and Certified Nutrition Specialists, mainly to qualify for those organizations, you find people mainly in research or in academics. By terms, Senator, I guess you might say, as a dietitian, I'm also a nutritionist. But there are people who are not dietitians who have a master's degree in nutrition, and that is what, and we want those people to be recognized along with dietitians. I think it's a question of semantics of name play. So, the grandfather clause is something that has we have looked at. In fact, we have talked about some options for wording of that. We'd be happy to submit some wording for a grandfather clause. What we're concerned with is not lowering the bar to qualify for licensure for people. We don't want to put people out of work. That is not our emphasis of this bill. But we'd be more than happy to submit a grandfather clause.
And then the consumer concerns, if the consumers had a problem with a dietitian, they can always go to the American Dietitian Association to revoke their...
I am not an expert on the bylaws of the American Dietetic Association, but I've been a member now for 17 years. I've been the president of the Alaska Dietetic Association. I've also been the Alaska delegate to the American Dietetic Association. I don't recall if there's an effort or there is bylaws within the American Dietetic Association that says that if a consumer has concerns that ADA can revoke their license, revoke their registration. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I can't answer that question or answer that concern straightforward. Regarding the exemptions, I will say that the original bill had 13 exemptions. In the process of doing the CS, we removed these two. The first one is that there are people who have either master's or PhDs in animal nutrition. I guess it's a question, should just because they work in veterinary situations, should they have to be required to be licensed when they're not teaching, they're not talking human nutrition, that they're dealing with veterinary situations. For the armed forces, that is a common exemption that is found in every licensure bill, and the rationale for that is pretty straightforward. Because most military personnel are on a two or three year rotation, when they move from site to site, out of state, so forth, if we were requiring licensure for them, they would have to be sometimes dinged twice for licensure bills, both in Alaska and then the other state that they're moving to, and that's a little unfair. It's our understanding that almost all licensure bills in the United States, of the 39 states, have the same exemption to exempt military personnel, mainly because of the rotation for most of the rotation criteria of the job.
And the other concern here is that I assume that all these folks would be forced to pay the $410, right?
That's what's been explained to our members.
That's a problem.
I have kept them informed of the situation. I told them back in the fall that I felt that two-year licensure fee would be in the area of $300 to $350, purely because we only have 120 people working in the field. The vote of the association was that a vast majority of them voted to continue this licensure effort and go forward with this. Are we going to make everybody happy with this? No, I'm afraid not. But.
Okay, well, when I first read this bill, I thought this was more for consumer protection. But as I understand it, you're forcing these dietitians to pay $410, and the consumers are already protected through the association that registered these nutrition. So if there's a problem, you just pull their license, or their registration, I guess is what it's called.
doesn't stop them from practicing the field, holding themselves out to be nutritionists or dietitians, though. The emphasis here is title recognition, is not consumer protection.
I'm just saying my interpretation. When I first looked at the field yesterday afternoon, my first impression, okay, this is going to be consumer protection. Sounds pretty good. But the deeper I got into it, and then getting a couple of calls from my home, or actually from my district, they raised some legitimate concerns in my mind. So just wanted to have you respond to those concerns. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Mr. Ray, is there anything to prohibit somebody working in the armed forces from going out and starting a business and be exempt from the clauses that are in here?
Outside the emphasis of the military?
This says if you're in the armed services, it doesn't say you have to be practicing and providing your service to in the line of the military or federal government.
My understanding is that if they wish to step out of the armed forces work that they do, because the armed forces does have dietitians that say at the El Mador Hospital, for example, they have two of them on staff. If they wish to set up a private practice outside, that is something they're doing outside the military, I would suspect that they would probably need to be licensed.
The bill doesn't exempt them from it entirely, so we may need a little clarifying language there, too. I would just assume maybe one of them would go to work for somebody else, but the bill says as long as you're serving in the armed forces that you're exempt from this entirely. It doesn't say it, if you're in private practice.
Right.
You must conform to this law.
Right.
So you may need a little fix there, too.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Senator Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, just so I understand. This bill doesn't limit one from practicing dietetic or nutritional, providing those services.
Correct.
What it does is if they want to hold themselves out as licensed dietitians or nutritionists.
Exactly.
That's what this bill does.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly.
And for that, one would pay $410 every other year.
Exactly.
And for that $410, they would be able to represent themselves as licensed and access some additional, said something about Medicaid or Medicare money?
That's a good point. The 106th Congress has legislation that is going to be released soon or submitted that would request that Medicare Part B outpatient services provide reimbursement for nutritional therapy for those professions who are legally recognized by that individual state as the experts in nutrition. And what you see many times is that Medicare standards are automatically taken up by Medicaid, Champus, TRICARE, who represent the VA programs, and sometimes even third-party payers as standards. Right now in my profession, if I get a patient who is a Medicare patient, chances are my hospital is giving those services away for free because there's no chance for them to get reimbursed for that. That's free work. And a big part of my practice, half of my business is outpatient referrals, trying to help people change behaviors to either reduce their chance of chronic diseases or help them deal with their chronic disease. So we want to be in a position where if this piece of legislation passes the Congress, Medicare decides that medical nutrition therapy should be a reimbursable service, that we are there, that we are the recognized parties in the state of Alaska, along with the other 39 states that have licensure.
So in regard to the $410, it's probably safe to assume that if one chose to join at $410, they would probably get those monies back over a two-year period by this additional level of recognition.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking of it. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions of the witness? Senator Green.
On page 2, it talks about the dietitian licensure and then the nutritionist licensure. And on line 9, it says, this evidence satisfactory of being certified as a registered dietitian by the Commission on Dietetic Registration. And what is composed and what has to have occurred to be certified by that group?
Like I mentioned a while ago, Senator, I have to show that I've passed successfully a degree from an accredited university, baccalaureate minimum.
Okay.
Then I have to apply for an internship, and that's basically a year of slave labor for some hospital somewhere around the country. Complete that internship, satisfactory evaluation, and then pass a day-long examination, very similar to what nurses do, physical therapists, and then I have to maintain 75 hours of continuing education credits every 5 years. Every 5 years. It's important to note that a lot of my peers in this state, like down south, have much more than baccalaureates. Many of them have master's degrees. I have a number of my peers have PhDs.
And then if you go down to the nutritionist licensure, and number one, it says qualified, according to the American Board of Nutrition, or a certified nutrition, or meets the following qualifications, has received a master's or doctoral degree, or and has completed a documented work experience in human nutrition or human nutrition research. Okay, is this the equivalent of an internship, that third part B?
Initially, when we wrote this bill, that was kind of the thinking, but we submit what this is. It's just basically work experience. Having done 900 hours working full-time, is about a year, as you probably know, we just want to make sure this person is coming out with a master's degree and is actually understand what the work experience is, because there is no internship mechanism for nutritionists.
I agree.
Okay, how does the number one qualification compare to the number 2A and B together? What is the qualification to come under of the American Board of Nutrition R as a certified nutrition specialist? What is that qualifying?
For nutrition. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow you, Senator.
It's lines 15 and 16 on page 2.
Okay. The American Board of Nutrition, I will be right up front with you. Some of this is redundant. To qualify for the American Board of Nutrition, you've got to have at least a master's degree. But they don't require the 900 hours of work experience. In reality, most of the people who are members of the American Board of Nutrition, are people working in academic settings or people who are working in research. Either for corporations or for universities, just doing solely research. These two organizations have contacted us and explained their membership criteria to us, and we had decided to add nutritionists to the licensure effort. We have five or six people in the state who perform very valuable services, and they should be recognized as a dietitian.
Do we have the research arm here in this state?
There is a person at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and one person at UA Anchorage who they're not doing solely research. They're also on the active faculty staff, but they do research. They're PhDs.
Ms. Kelly, I have another question. I'm just curious why we don't have a fiscal note on the anticipated cost. Medicare, if we would have any additional responsibility on our side, or if there's reimbursement begins.
Good question. Maybe ask that of the partners who are here to testify on that. Do you have any comments on that question?
Sure. Senator, I can barely hear Medicare, but I couldn't hear him. Sorry.
There's a question on whether or not there should be an additional fiscal note to represent the cost that you're testifying to would be available if you had this licensure from Medicare.
Well, as of right now, there is no provision within Medicare for nutrition therapy being reimbursed. And until Congress passes the law, there's no way of knowing what will be passed. There's already well-established limited criteria for reimbursement within Medicaid for high-risk pregnancies, for one, but it's very limited. But there is nothing within Medicare at this point that says that nutrition therapy will be this specific service will be reimbursed or this specific disease will be reimbursed. So my answer is that there will be there's nothing there to stipulate that we need reimbursement.
Yeah, but if you're anticipating reimbursement at some future time, we can anticipate some future cost. And I just think we need to be able to balance that out and find out where we're headed.
I understand you're getting that. I wish I could think of a mechanism of how to approach that, but I don't know.
Any other questions? Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, to the witness, the 900 hours of work experience, you said, I thought I heard you say that represents a year of work. That's really about half a year.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Ray, for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we have Linda Wild. Morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Linda Wild. I won't repeat the points that John Ray made in his testimony, but I kind of like to speak to licensing as nutritionist and dietitian from my own perspective. I'm a nutritionist. I'm currently licensed in Washington State, where I received my advanced degree. And I did this, I'm giving Washington State my money every year because it's important to me to have the professional recognition that licensing provides, especially because Alaska does not license. So there's no way of knowing if someone's calling themselves a nutritionist right now, if they've had appropriate training in the field. So I feel that having that through Washington State gives me that kind of professional credentials. When someone looks in the phone book and they're wanting nutritional counseling, for example, if they look under nutrition, they may see names of the whole alphabet soup of letters behind them. And I think to most people, those letters don't really make a whole lot of sense. But what people understand, what they recognize, what they feel comfortable with, is if someone is licensed by the state, they know that the state has looked at this person and that this person has met at least the minimum qualifications for recognition in that field. And I think that's important to people. And I think it's important to the profession as well. And it's important for us as nutritionists and dietitians to be essentially put on the same playing field as other healthcare professionals. As you might suspect, dietitians and nutritionists are really passionate about the benefits of healthy eating and good nutrition. And to me, sound nutrition is a real key to the establishment and maintenance of good health. Therapeutic nutrition helps people recover from illnesses more quickly and do a better job of it. And good nutrition helps prevent a number of the chronic diseases that many people, including a lot of us aging baby boomers, might be susceptible to as time goes on. I can speak just real quickly, Senator Phillips, to a couple of points that you brought up. I talked with, in working with the bill, I spoke with ADA, the American Dietetic Association's national person regarding the military exemption was one of the specific ones. And in addition to what John Ray said, she indicated to me that many states now in the military is actually beginning to require their dietitians to be licensed in their own states. In Alaska, we have, maybe one or two military dietitians, so it's not like a big deal, but it is something that's happening. In terms of if they're doing any moonlighting on the side, I have, in looking at some other states' legislation, seen some very brief language saying they're accepted as long as they're performing those duties within their job. If they go out and moonlight, then they become licensed. Because, I mean, if that sort of community desire conceptual amendment would be accepted by us. Regard to the two classes, I think it's important to not make it so that only people who are registered dietitians are licensed, but nutritionists are recognized as well. I think otherwise that would essentially give this one organization a lock on the profession, recognizing that nutritionists are required to have a minimum of a master's degree, and we're requiring them to have the work experience. and these other organizations certify nutritionists as well. So I think it's important to recognize both classes, if you will, of dietitians and nutritionists. In terms of the grandfathering, we, as he mentioned, we had looked at that as well. And the reason we hadn't put it in there is that it's pretty much a moot point. If you're a registered dietitian, you're licensed. You either are or you aren't. The only people that it might apply to would be nutritionists. In terms of nutritionists around the state, there's me and maybe just a couple others. I don't know of anyone that hasn't met the requirements of the bill. If the committee has concerns about that, again, we could do perhaps a conceptual amendment that says, yes, you have, what, 2 years to meet the work experience requirements. I do think it's important to keep in the educational requirements having met. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What do you pay for your license in Washington?
I pay $200 biannually, but I have to point out that there are many more in Washington State than there are here.
Senator Green, did you have a question?
Currently, are you in private practice here?
I do have a small private practice. However, I am involved this winter in a dietetic internship program, so I'm on my way to becoming a registered dietitian.
Okay, so when you had your stationery or your card printed, did you say that you were licensed in Washington and certified, board
in
certified?
In Washington, it's called certified. I said certified nutritionist.
And I assume that's board certified? Or
it's not a board. They have requirements. You know, they have statutes of requirements.
They're different.
For nutritionists, basically, you have to have a master's in nutrition and in an appropriate field, and you have to, in Washington State, you have to complete a special AIDS course, which I did for them.
So were you to have to qualify as for a license in Alaska, you would just
fall
right into it?
Right, because I have the experience and the educational.
And the license would basically... Okay, again, tell me what the difference is in your being able to put licensed by your name instead of certified, since the qualifications are the same.
There's no real difference. Some states call it licenses, some states call it certification. Alaska, for instance, midwives are called certified nurse midwives, but they're licensed. So mm-hmm. The terms are really interchangeable in Alaska. It's just some states call them one thing, some states call them another.
Thank you.
Other questions of this? There are none. Thank you for joining us this morning. Next, we have Catherine Reardon.
Hello, for the record, my name is Catherine Reardon, Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing in the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. I'm basically here to answer questions about the fiscal note or other subjects regarding our administration of this law if it passes.
How come it's so expensive?
Mr. Chair, the second page of the fiscal note describes the items that made up the fiscal note, and I actually think that they're relatively modest. My initial fiscal note was $28,000 a year, and I met with the advocates of the bill and talked to the sponsor's aide about exactly what it would take to license and brought it down to 15. I'm asking for 2.5 months of a range 12 licensing examiner. A quarter position. I do have a half position right now. We'll see how the budget comes out, but right now I have a half position that I would move up to a three-quarter position. And then I'm asking for some AG time and $1,000 for supplies. One thing that's not in there is investigator time, if there are complaints that have to be investigated. So that activity we're absorbing. So I do want to say that as you probably understand, the fiscal note reflects what new expenditure authority I'm requesting. Fees will actually be based on the resources that we truly spend on a profession. That could be to their benefit or their detriment, in that if I say I can run the program with a quarter of a range 12, basically, but it turns out that we actually have to redirect some resources of other staff, for example, we have an investigation or we have someone appeals their license denial and goes off to Superior Court on it, we need to spend more legal resources than the $3,000. We will indeed spend those resources and not spend them on another profession. And the fees will reflect what we actually do for the profession. So Mr. Ray mentioned that quite possibly fees could be lower after the first startup, because I think it's reasonable that it will take 2.5 months of someone's time to get the program up and going, do application forms, mail them out, and contact people. A lot of contact will come from applicants that first year who are interested. I mean, it may slow down, I would expect it to slow down in later years, but at the same time, there are other activities, such as enforcement, that may pick up in later years, so it could be that fees go up as well as that they go down. And I just wanted to state that for the record, so no one will feel tripped. That was a long answer, but basically I think it takes a quarter of a person to run a licensing program.
Other questions? There are none. Thank you for joining us this morning. That's all I have signed up to testify. Oh, Senator Phillips.
Is anybody from the Department of Health Services here?
Not that I'm aware of.
I had a question on the Medicaid, Medicare, or whatever, future charges, because that's going to have a future effect on our budget, and that was what I was really getting at after as a member of the Finance Committee, the potential costs, and I don't know what they are right now.
Thank you, Kathy. Anyone else here that would like to testify on Senate Bill 88? Hearing none, we do have a CS in front of us. Senator Donnelly, it sounds like we're going to have a couple more amendments, work on the grandfather clause and the military language, cleanup language, and then Senator Phillips would like to have Hess here to testify before we move the bill out. So we could adopt the CS now, or you could incorporate the other changes, and I'll leave it up.
I think I should try to incorporate the changes. What I was looking to is making clear that the exemption for federal employees only applies. I'm not sure what Senator Phillips wants for grandfather clause.
I'll get a hold of you later on that.
Okay. All right. Anything else? The questions of the sponsor or anything else in the bill for today? Hearing none, we will set Senate Bill 88 aside and let the sponsor work with concerned members and bring us back to CS. Next, we will go to House Bill 27.
I can't tell you how relieved I am this morning.
House Bill 27 is an act relating to financial aid received for medical education. Prime sponsor is Representative Mulder. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you very much, Co-Chairman Torgerson, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to see you this morning. Can't tell you how relieved I am, not because of this bill, but for other reasons.
Sorry about TV last night.
We did report the bill out last night and expect to have it to the floor tomorrow, or on Monday, providing everything goes okay in caucus tomorrow. So it's nice to have that work fast behind us, and don't envy you and your work for the next couple weeks. I'm really pleased that you took the time to schedule CS for House Bill 27. It's a very simple bill in its concept. All it really does is allow Alaskan students opportunity or access to post-secondary educational opportunities through the use of the Alaska Student Loan Program. If you remember, in the past, we participated in the Professional Student or Exchange Program, but due to budgetary constraints, and where it was a subsidy program, but due to budgetary constraints, we concluded we can no longer participate. What this bill simply allows for is that we would hold slots within the Wichita arena for the Professional Student Exchange Program through the utilization of the Student Loan Program. Alaska students would then be able to get slots in those positions or those fields, but it would be then a full loan repayment program. You have several opportunities here, but the biggest consideration, Mr. Chairman, is one of access, really. These are professional fields that are very competitive, very difficult to get into. Dentistry, veterinary medicine, physical therapy, occupational therapy, optometry, podiatry, osteopathic medicine, and physician assistant. They're fields that we don't have within the University of Alaska. It would be very expensive to establish these programs in our state. And by not offering or not having any access directly through participation in the Professional Student Exchange Program, our students just flat aren't able to get into some of these programs. Through this mechanism, we can now begin to hold slots for Alaska students. It's really the key, is that we'll be able to actually hold slots. And to that end, I guess I received a letter this week that was totally unsolicited. I don't know this woman at all, but she really amplifies the point. She's from Wasilla. She said, "Dear sir, I'm writing in support of House Bill 27. In the past, I recently learned that you are supporting or sponsoring the bill, which will allow for Alaska's residents to pursue higher educational opportunities through the use of the WICHE program, which I understood Alaska has not participated in since 1997. As a concerned resident and parent, I encourage our state to assist our young people to develop professionally, thereby beginning bringing needed services back to the state of Alaska. I'm intimately aware of two young people wishing to go into the medical field. One, our son, now 24 years old, obtained a degree from Michigan State University and sought to enroll in a master's program in physical therapy. Qualifies for such programs based on his undergraduate studies. His friend, also in the same age, desires to enroll in medical school, having obtained her undergraduate degree appropriately as well. Both young people have Alaska residency. However, neither of the programs are available in Alaska. The cost of the programs are prohibitive without some financial assistance to them. They both have plans to apply and enroll in the WICHE program, only to learn Alaska no longer participates. Our son has also applied to outside schools, only to be told school was not accepting out-of-state applications. Therefore, it appears my son and his friend will be forced to leave Alaska, establish residency outside, to pursue their higher education, and to make it somewhat affordable by not having to pay the entire amount as an upfront cost. I would encourage our state of Alaska to facilitate and support our young people in pursuing of higher education, especially in fields not available through our University of Alaska. In return, I believe these young people would encourage our young people to develop a sense of appreciation and dedication, and more likely for them to return back to Alaska. Both of these individuals are very hardworking, industrious, and would bring credit to the people of this state. Let's not send our young people away due to the lack of availability. Thank you for pursuing this need. Your time, your support, and interest in sponsoring House Bill 27 is signed by Lona Lyle from Wasilla." And I think she amplifies the problem we're trying to address. It's availability. You just can't get into some of these programs unless you're an in-state resident. This bill would provide that opportunity. There are other provisions within the bill, or there are expressions toward the WAMI program. All that happens there, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is the fact that last year, when we passed the WAMI bill, making it a repayment program for those who did not return to the state of Alaska, it moves that provision of statute, which is wholly unchanged, to another portion of the statute. It is currently in the loan program, but because WAMI is sort of a hybrid loan program, really should be in another portion of the statute, and so it was more appropriately shifted. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I do believe the department, as they've been working on this, has a prepared amendment, which I think they would like to offer to you. It is a technical correction, and I think they would speak to it.
Representative Mulder, Section 2 is the whammy, deals with whammy. Is that right?
That's correct.
And none of that is being amended. That's just shifting to a different statute. That's current law, all of that section.
That is all current law. Nothing has changed within this bill.
Okay.
I just wanted that clarified. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah, I just had, on the fiscal note, they're talking about that the fiscal analysis is predicated upon statements that no forgiveness benefits are intended in House Bill 27.
Correct.
I'm a little taken back by upon statements that the bill doesn't stipulate any repayments at all as far as the whammy does it.
The bill does say it's in the loan program, Mr. Chairman, and it says that the regulations would be established by the Post-Secondary Education Commission. We give them the authority to develop those regulations, and as such, they clearly understand that they cannot afford and we cannot afford a grant-type program. That would be strictly a loan program.
Senator Wilkins.
Chairman, are you looking for a motion to move the amendment?
Go ahead.
I move amendment number one.
Well,
first of all, it's not labeled.
It's got to be logged in here first. Senator Phillips?
Do we have a committee substitute for it officially?
No, we have the bill.
It's not labeled substitute. Or the bill?
I'm going to log in the amendment.
Well, I just wanted to inquire if the bill is before us, or has the motion been made to adopt the committee substitute, first of all?
We don't have a committee substitute. It's the House substitute.
Sorry, the House substitute.
We have CS itself. For House Bill 27.
Yeah, the bill itself.
There's no committee substitute.
There's no committee. There's an amendment being offered by
to
Senator Wilkins.
I got it.
Close number one by Senator Wilkins.
We have amendment number one. Offered by Senator Wilkins. Senator Wilkins made a motion for us to adopt amendment number one. I'll object just to hear what we're doing here.
It's inappropriate. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'd like to explain it, Mr. Chairman, but I know I can do it, but I think the department and Representative Mulder can do it even better.
Okay.
Chairman, I will defer to Diane Barron.
Okay, Diane, if you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with the testimony.
Yes. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Post-Secondary Education Commission. Essentially, what the amendment does is ensure that the Student Loan Corporation, through the commission, can fund this program. It explicitly adds, under the Student Loan Fund Uses section of statute, an inclusion for the WICHE. Basically, what will be the WICHE loan program, which will be a separate loan program.
Okay, on page 4, line 5, in the middle of your amendment, the repayment under this section shall be paid to the student loan fund. That's what are we doing there?
Mr. Chair, that section allows that as we collect the repayments, they're going back into the fund and will recycle.
And that's normal procedure for the other loans?
Absolutely.
Okay. Senator Green.
Oh, and I don't recall when Richie was discontinued, but was it basically Section 1 of the CS, or the bill before us, is that what was withdrawn in 97, and are we just bringing it back when after Richie?
Through the chair, Senator Green, the 42030 was a section that authorized whammy. This is a technical change that's being made in Section 1 because we're moving the WAMI loan program from 1444, where it should not have been located, because that's the statute that references WICHE, and WAMI is not a WICHE program, and references the new location for WAMI, which is 1443-510. And that's what Section 2 does, is it moves it into the appropriate section of statute. It's a technical change.
Section 1 refers to what?
The WAMI program.
Okay, where is the language then that where it says the WICHE program will be able to develop slots and have slots in?
Section, the WICHE program actually references within the bill, Senator, begin on Section 3, page 3.
And that Section 3, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Section 3 is where you provide to reserve slots for Alaska students?
Through the chair, Senator Green, actually the entire text of the WICHE Compact is set out in 1444. The only sections you see here are the ones that are being amended. So in order to review the entire intent and structure of the WICHE program, you would need to review 1444 of the statute. What Section 3 does, it allows the commission to set the terms and conditions of what's going to be a new program in concept. It's a loan program in regulation. So the language, I can't remember from memory what the specific section reference is that says the purpose of the professional student exchange program is to secure access, but it does say that.
I was just curious because I don't know, I'm not sure what you said, but so the WICHE program was never repealed. It just wasn't funded.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. That's what I was. Thank you.
Senator Lehman and Senator Adams.
While we're on that, even though it strays from the amendment, but it's something that's brought to my attention as recently as last week by a parent of a student who was applying for dentistry school. I think I heard Representative Mulder correctly. I think I understand how it works, but there are slots that in these other states that are given priority to their residents, and our students, through the WICHE Compact, have, I understand, the same priority as those in the other states. Is that correct? Or
through the chair, Senator Lehman, when we're participating and funding slots, that is correct. Since the state has not participated in this exchange program, gradually those schools have started saying no and rejecting the applications from Alaska.
Well, I understand that we don't currently, but through this change, that would enable us, for our students then, to have the same priority, to regain that priority. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Lehman, that's correct. The concern that, and this is sort of getting to testimony, but the concern that the corporation would have is that when making the decision to prioritize funding you through this new program, we would want to consider the risk to the fund. In certain of the fields, the amount that students would be borrowing is so great that there is no expectation that they would be able to repay that entire debt at when they go into repayment without some forgiveness benefit, which we don't expect to see here. So the commission would probably look at the amount of debt that they would be lending in each field and make decisions about whether or not they can afford to take that risk. The cost per year per field varies from a low of about $4,000 per year to a high of $23,000 per year. And it's unlikely that someone would be able to repay $200,000 in debt in certain of these fields. And for instance, veterinary medicine is one that's a good example. We currently have a number of veterinarians or several veterinarians who are having trouble paying the debt that they borrowed through the regular student loan program. And so for the corporation to lend them $80,000 in principal and expect to receive back with interest something like $160,000 or $170,000, would not be a good risk. But the commission will have to analyze that when setting the funding priorities.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to do this. I just want to make sure I understand. Okay, provided the commission decides that that loan should be made or could be made, and that loan is made, does that student then get the same or equivalent priority in that other state program as their own resident?
To the chair, yes, they do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Adams and Senator Dunn.
I know my question is along this amendment, but my question is we're looking at slots for the number of students in Alaska. Is there any cost benefit to Alaskans under this new program versus a student that has to pay an out-of-state tuition at the same facility or university?
To the chair, Senator Adams, generally not. It's not black and white, yes or no, because the way the support fee is the fee that is paid to the school to accept our residents. In some cases, the support fee is more than the differential for non-resident. In some cases, it's less than, because you actually have a range of institutions offering training in that professional field. They have different fee structures, and so when all the vet schools get together and set their rates, they all set one single support fee that they're willing to accept, whether that's higher than their non-resident or less than their non-resident. But in most cases, it is either less than or equal to the differential. So it's a minor economic benefit. The real benefit, as Representative Mulder has stated, is that they get considered for admission, whereas their application would have been rejected outright without that consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Donnelly, then Senator Green.
I just wanted to go back to that point that Senator Lehman was exploring. I don't understand how the forgiveness provision buys us more seats at schools. Can we do that through a separate appropriation? You have to buy the seats for Alaskans through the program, buying into the program?
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay. Buy our way into the WICHE program. Are we currently appropriating money to buy our way into the WICHE program?
Through the chair, the state is a member of the WICHE program. We actively participate in two other student exchange programs as a benefit of that membership, yes.
Okay. So how does this bill make any difference in the number of positions we get in other universities through WICHE?
The third exchange program is a professional student exchange program. It is the only one of the three exchange programs that requires states to pay an additional cost above membership. In other words, there's a per participant support fee that we have to pay for every resident. We have to agree in advance with the institutions that we're going to fund X number of slots, say three slots in optometry, five in physical therapy. So we have to agree in advance so that the schools know that if they do give this preferential consideration to our students as what they call WICHE resident students, that there will be funding to follow those offers of admission. They do make the offers of admission contingent upon receiving the funding. That is not the case with the other student exchange program.
And where's that funding in this fiscal note?
The fiscal analysis basically is in the bottom. bottom line of the analysis. It says the level of participation would be 157.3 in the first year, rising to 530 in full participation. The reason it's asterisk is because they are not, it's not an appropriated item. The actual funds that we loan to students is a non-operating item, so it did not appear in the fiscal note grid.
But you said that it wasn't just loans, it was you had to make payments to these universities to save spots, right?
That's correct, but the students would repay not only the participation, but they'd also pay that slot fee. So they wouldn't pay just for the education, but they'd also pay for the privilege of having that slot.
You mean the ones that didn't come back to Alaska?
All of them.
But I thought that this only applied to medical. Maybe I missed something.
That's whammy.
No, whammy's totally different. But there's a medical component within the ordinary witchy loan program too, right? I mean.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Donnelly, I would not anticipate that medical students would be funded through this program. Because it is a program that's available in Alaska, and the terms of sending students in WICHE programs is that they be programs not available in Alaska, and also that the cost of WICHE medical participation for a student would be in that high range. These people would be incurring about $200,000 in debt through this program. Realistically, they could not afford to repay that amount of money. And that's where my reference to a work service obligation came into my comments earlier, that's an unreasonable risk for the corporation to take.
I'm really trying to understand the bill. I guess it's Saturday morning, and I'm just not as quickly as I should here. So let me try again. So the bill would take money from the existing reserves for loans and use it to sign these agreements, pay for these agreements with the different universities. I guess we'd target to certain ones. Buy spots for Alaskans in those universities.
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly. Essentially, what we would do is we would just reactivate our participation in the Professional Student Exchange Program. The participants in this new version of the program would agree when they applied for WICHE certification that they would be obliged to repay the support fee that the state pays.
Now, the section that's on page 2 of the bill, that's the whammy section. And that you're just here because you're moving that to another section of the law. So where's the repayment provision for the new WICHE program?
In the amendment that's before you.
I guess I don't understand how the amendment works then.
I think it's the top of page 4, Senator Donnelly. It just says the program participants shall agree to repay the state for the support provided by the state on behalf of the persons plus interest. And this would be the amendment would say that the repayment would be paid back to the student loan fund. That's
correct. Since the student loan fund is the source of the funds, it simply allows for the repayment.
But isn't that the repayment provision at the top of page 4?
It is.
Right.
Okay, so for this new WICHE program, it's just an ordinary loan program. There's no forgiveness provided for those loans.
That's correct.
Sorry, I'm just trying.
Good, to clarify it for everybody. Senator Green and Senator Kelly.
When we dealt with the changes to the student loan bill 2 or 3 years ago, we had some very clearly spelled out fees and caps on how much you could borrow per year. But I noticed there's no reference to a floor or a ceiling. Is there a ceiling?
Through the chair, Senator Green, the ceiling would be the fixed cost of the support fees. We can't actually put a cap in because those support fees are generally renegotiated every 2 years or so as the institution come back to the table with WICCHI and say, we need a 3% adjustment because we need to cover more of our costs through this program. So we can't actually set a cap. I would expect the commission in developing regulations for this to perhaps set a cap between the two programs so that if someone as an undergraduate borrowed from the Alaska Student Loan Program and then they borrow from this program for their professional study, that they could borrow no additional graduate money from the Alaska Student Loan Program, because potentially the amount of debt that they could have between both programs could be quite considerable. Right now, the cap, if you borrow the maximum as an undergraduate and graduate, is $60,000.
Okay. Senator Kelly, then Senator Wilkins, then Senator Donnelly, then Senator Parnell.
My question was answered in the discussion with Senator Donnelly.
Okay. Senator Wilkins?
Mr. Chairman, I have two questions, but if they're more general in nature. Would you like them now or after we finish?
No, go ahead. We got them at the table.
Diane, you stated that the exposure is somewhere between $157,000 and $530,000 if we covered all fields. What's the total amount of loans that you'll put out this year?
About $69 million.
Okay. So we're somewhere in $500,000 out of $70 million. Okay. And do you, this year the student loan program is going to report its first, or has reported its first profit, if there's such a thing as that, due to your efforts and a lot of folks over the last, since it's been put in place, do you expect that this legislation will have a negative impact on that continued profitability?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkin, we do not. I think that the commission will have the flexibility in regulation to take steps to ensure that there isn't a loss to the corporation associated with this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Donnelly.
Just before I go on this other question, how much can a non-whammy medical student borrow now?
$60,000.
Total over there, but how much per year?
$9,500.
$9,500 a year. Yeah, okay. Before we took WICCHI out of the budget, was there statutory authorization similar to this before and it got removed somehow? Or did it just used to be a budget item and then you did this on your own?
The chair did what on our own?
Took care of the stuff that's reflected here in the bill. I mean, my understanding, we used to have a line item in the budget for WICCHI that paid for this. We took that out of the budget. Right? So I'm starting to, I'm starting to think that this bill is a way to do what we used to do with a line item in the budget without having to have a line item in the budget, by accessing those funds that used to be there through the loan program, right? I mean, through the fund, okay, I'm getting it, yeah. So then you'll make the choice about which particular professions you would go in. It'd just be up to the post-secondary commission to decide which professions you want to go buy spots with this money. And we wouldn't know whether it could range pretty drastically between these dollar amounts, depending on whatever you chose to go out and buy, right?
Through the chair, Senator Donnelly, both the commission and the corporation have gone on record that they would choose the field based primarily on Alaska workforce needs, and then secondly identify those fields that Alaskans have the most difficulty accessing, and then thirdly, considering the debt issue. In other words, how much through these fees would they have to borrow? So those would be the criteria in regulation. I would imagine that the commission would have to review on a periodic basis what fields to fund, because if we have an inflow of physical therapists and occupational therapists, we might actually meet state workforce needs and then perhaps open an opportunity for funding to go to other slots.
And the reason you don't think they're going to do medical schools is because people would borrow $60,000, the maximum, and then not be able to pay it back. So the commission would be less likely to expand this applicability to medical students?
Through the chair, they would actually be borrowing potentially $47,000 as undergraduates, and then if they participated in a medical support through this, they would be borrowing an additional $90,000 in principal, because the support fee per year for a medical student through WICHE is $23,000 per year.
Oh, so you've got a $23,000 support fee, plus you've got the $9,500 that can borrow. You had to, so... it's still cheaper than the WAMI program. A lot cheaper. Yeah.
Senator Parnell.
Did your $9,500 figure, going back to Senator Donnelly's question, I understand you to say that a non-WAMI medical student could borrow $9,500 annually up to a maximum of 60. Okay. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Parnell, they can borrow as undergraduates $8,500 per year, and frankly, the WAMI students do, in order to pay the other costs of their education, which are considerable. They borrow $8,500 a year for 4 or 5 years of undergraduate, and then can borrow $9,500 a year for graduate study, to a total cap of $60,000. However, that spreads between undergraduate and graduate.
And the postgraduate, $9,500 annually, is an Alaska student loan, postgraduate loan.
Cap, yes.
Right, but it's an Alaska student loan.
Yes.
Okay. So that's available to any postgraduate student, not just medical students.
That's correct.
Okay, and then is there a medical student only loan program on top of that, or is this it, postgraduate, is $9,500?
Senator Parnell, there is no special loan program.
And then, okay, that helps out. Thank you. Thanks.
Other questions of our witnesses? Sponsor.
I've never known that before, because we never had
it. Hearing none, we do have amendment number one in front of us. It has been moved. Is there objection to adopting amendment number one? Hearing no objection, amendment number one will be adopted. Any more discussion on the bill? Senator Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Diane or Eldon, on page one, line 12, after medical education, should the word degree be inserted there, or is that understood because of the insertion of the word degree up on line 10? Is that an oversight of drafting?
Senator Lehman, it is not.
Senator Wilkins.
Are you ready for a motion?
Actually, I'm ready for a short at ease. We'll take about a 2 minute at ease. Any more discussion on House Bill 27? Senator Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move to report House Bill 27 in committee with individual recommendations and attached indeterminate fiscal note.
There's a motion to move the Senate Finance for House Bill 27 out of committee with individual recommendations. Is there objection? Hearing none, House Bill 27 Senate CS for House Bill 27, moves from committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Next, we'll go to House Bill 10. House Bill 10 is an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives and providing for an effective date. Prime sponsor is here, Representative Hudson. Representative Hudson, I appreciate you hanging through all our debates here this morning. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
For the committee meeting, too.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the first thing I was going to do is apologize for my unseemly wear here, but I have a date with my granddaughter. And
birthday party.
It doesn't call for a coat and tie. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce Marilyn Holmes, who is a member of the Midwives Board here in Juneau and has been instrumental in helping us understand and push this bill along. And I've asked her if she would join me at the end of the table here to answer any professional or practical hands-on questions that you might have. She won't get too descriptive.
Questions of the sponsor on House Bill 10? Senator Parnell.
Motion to move. Mr. Chairman, I understand exactly where you want to go right now for a moment, but I also want to just make sure that I want to make sure our guests find out whether our guest is here just to answer any questions, or if are you here, ma'am, just to answer any questions we might have. You don't have a statement you want to give us?
No.
Okay. Thank you much. Mr. Chairman, I would move HB 10 from Committee of Individual Recommendations.
There's a motion to move HB 10 out of committee with individual recommendations. Is there objection?
Have a good time, Bill.
Hearing none, that's a Senate Finance record.
Thank you.
Next bill we have before us.
Don't go there.
They direct the exit.
Doesn't know what it means.
Is there anyone here on House Bill 71?
Long time to figure out.
Are you here to tell? Okay. Well, next we'll go to House Bill 71. This is an act establishing AIRAC. Anyway, to the Regional Housing Authority.
IRAC.
Apologize to everyone. Okay, the sponsor staff is here. Could you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and present the bill, please?
Senator Torgerson, committee members, for the record, I'm Larry LeBole, staff to Representative Foster. House Bill 71 is a technical change to AS 1855-996, and it changes the name of the association that has given the authority to appoint the Board of Commissioners for the Bering Strait Regional Housing Authority. It's a one-word change in current statute on line 8. It deletes Bering Strait Association and designates Quirk Incorporated. Bering Strait Native Association, or Straits Association, was an earlier organization that has been supplanted by Quirk. And the name change would do two things. It would allow them to conduct business without going into recess, reconvening as the Bering Straits Association to act upon that particular item. And secondly, I think it would guarantee that their actions would be deemed legal and not challengeable by some other group at some future time.
Okay. Senator Phillips.
Are you aware of any other state statutes where the words Bering Straits Association shows up?
Through the chair, Senator Phillips, I am not.
Question, Senator Parnell.
I did have an email from a constituent which just pointed out that, at least it was pointed out that the title might be misleading. His comment was that this really doesn't establish Quirk as the regional housing authority for the area, or does it? I mean,
Through the chair, Senator Parnell, that is correct. That was a title change done in House CRA. I have received some concerns over the title change. I guess my response to that was that if you look at what the statute does, it only changes this one word, so it does not, in fact, change the statute.
The
change the course of history.
Senator Parnell.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would move HB71 from committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying zero fiscal note.
Motion to move HB71 CRA out of committee. Is there objection? Hearing none, we set a second record.
Thank you.
House Bill 71 moves out of committee with individual recommendations.
2 hours and 15 minutes.
Next. We have. Okay, we'll take the short of these. We moved the two bills so fast, the sponsor of the next bill is not here yet. So, body break. Here at the table, the next bill we'll take up is House Bill 93. This is an act relating to Alaska Housing Finance Corporation Rural Assistance Loan Program. Prime sponsor, Representative Morgan, has joined us this morning to introduce the bill to us. Welcome, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ferguson. I'm going to speak all in Yupik because this bill, I can't translate it in English. I'm introducing this bill. I think this bill was up before. It was a bill, I think, that Ivan did, but we took it and dressed it up and made it passable, I think. And I don't want it to be a rural versus urban. I kind of want it, and I hope that don't get in there. I know there'll be some amendments, and I do welcome them. I know there'll be one on 1%, and I think if that do come up, it would put a damper on this bill. I think that should be another bill introduced by itself. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, can I read my speech?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, it'll be in, remember, it's going to be in Yupik, so you'll have to really listen.
I'll translate.
Okay.
You can.
Chairman Ferguson and members of the Senate Finance Committee, I'm before you today to speak on House Bill 93. Specifically, this legislation would modify HFC's rural mortgage program to allow two simple changes. First, the rural mortgage program would allow for refinancing of home loans in the same manner any conventional mortgage allows. While many people across Alaska and the United States have taken advantage of low interest rates to refinance their home mortgages, state law simply does not provide this as an option under the rural lending program. Second, the current definition in state law limits the term housing to either single-family and owner-occupied duplexes. This legislation would bring this term into compliance with current industry standards for lending by allowing owner-occupied housing up to 4 units. Simply, the rural mortgage program would be allowed to finance up to 4-plexes. This is the same standard that is used by VA, FHA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and AHFC's conventional urban loan programs. It is important to note that this bill does not allow the rural mortgage program to make any kind of loans that are not allowed under conventional lending practice or industry standards. The bill attempts to allow the rural mortgage program to make the same kind of loans allowed for any conventional urban loan program. For example, in February of 1998, HFC established a streamlined refinance program that allows borrowers with an HFC urban mortgage to refinance their home loans with a minimal transaction cost. By allowing homeowners to take advantage of current low interest rates, HFC reports that over 1,100 loans were refinanced in 1998. This bill would amend state law to simply allow the same kind of opportunities for rural borrowers. HFC rural loan portfolio has over 1,100 loans with interest rates over 8%, totaling approximately $115 million. Of these loans, just over 500 have a rate of higher than 9%. The current interest rate for the rural mortgage program is 6.125% for a 30-year loan. Lowering home loans by a whole percentage point can lower monthly payments by hundreds of dollars, essentially putting the buying power back into the homeowner's pocket and the state economy. This is not in any sense a giveaway program. The rural mortgage program is a revolving fund. HFC reports that default rates in the rural mortgage program are generally the same or